jazz.
Busted.
All right. Sounds like fun. Well, welcome to Jazz Bastard episode 156. He's here under duress. He's Mike.
He's Pat. He wants to be here. I want to be here too. I just want other things not to be in the way.
Yeah, Mike's computer has been holding him hostage for the last 20 minutes, but it finally gave in. You know, we're going to do our 6th anniversary special today. We're doing sextets. This is an idea Mike came up with quite a while back, that for the year anniversary, we do that number of people in a group. And of course, you looked up what kind of anniversary this is, right? You know what the...
Of course not. I trust you to do that for us. But what is it?
It's iron.
Iron.
And apparently you're supposed to like get your loved one a rose dipped in iron because that isn't creepy. That's good. I don't know.
It's not creepy if you're a goth. It sounds like a lot of fun. I don't know. Rose dipped in iron? How do you get a rose dipped in iron anyway?
Google tells all. I don't know. Anyway.
Wouldn't molten iron just turn the rose to ashes the moment you dip the... I mean, because iron is, you know, it's an ore that comes from the ground and it has to be heated, presumably, to be liquefied, at which point it's so warm, surely the rose could not take that treatment.
Well, I got a C- in metallurgy, so I just don't know. All my roses melted, but then I was just bad at it.
That sounds like a country music song, All My Roses Done Melted.
That's right. I kept sticking them in that hot metal. They kept just melting away.
Oh, right. I forgot. I meant to oil my chair. So if they're squeaking, I can always count on you to let me know. But hopefully I've got my chair in an oily spot. That sounds disgusting. I hope I have it in an oily place so we don't get undue squeaking during the course of this.
Well, either of us, you know, if we're not talking, the mics are amazing at magnifying whatever else we're doing. So yeah, I've got some amazing, I could do a real hot mix of, you know, Mike's chair, but I haven't done it. You know, I just cut him out. I just muted
or the dog or the dog barking. There's a dog barking.
Yeah, the dog I can't always cut out because he tends to like wait till you're talking. Then he's like, all right, yeah. Motherfucker, now I'm going to weigh in.
You know? he is the third member of the podcast. Yeah,
absolutely. What do you think of this recording? Bark. Oh, okay. Bark. Good insights there.
It's a high-pitched bark. It's a high-pitched bark, not a low, throaty growl.
No. Very penetrating. Absolutely. Little fucker. So anyway, we're going to do... It turns out 6 sextet recordings.
Jesus, what were we thinking?
I don't know. And they're from all over the map, all different times, different styles. So
mine are later, yours are earlier, you dipwad.
For the most part, yeah. So the ones I picked out, Lester Young sextet, I think it's called the Kansas City 6, a clutch of 5 recordings from 1939. And I picked out John Kirby's complete sextet recordings on Columbia and Victor, I believe, from also roughly speaking 1939, 1940. This is a compilation, obviously, of 78s. We're just doing disc one of that. And then finally, I picked out John Jang's Two Flowers on a Stem, a soul note joint from 1996. And what were your selections?
That's a great question. I wonder if I can remember them. A date led by Albert Eiler, well, nominally led by Albert Eiler, called New York Sound.
Ear and Eye Control.
Eye and Ear Control. Eye and Ear Control, which is a pretty free affair. And then John Zorn, on his 50th birthday, did approximately 1 million commemorative albums. And some of these were, there's a whole slew of these put out by his Sodic label. And this one was this is actually a 3-disc set. Now, let me just remind you, his 50th birthday was a month-long affair. It was celebrated over the period of 1 month. And there were many different ensembles playing, some of them including him. But this does not include him. It's a sextet. And I went soft. I thought you'd appreciate this. It's a string sextet playing the music of John Zorn.
Yeah, the Bar Kokhba sextet.
Yeah, get some phlegm in there. Bar Kokhba, you know?
And so it's, yeah, from his 50th birthday celebration, volume 11.
And that tells you, yeah.
2 of 3 from 2003.
Yes, and so there were like, I think, 31 or 35 volumes. And they're not all single disc. Lots of them are double and triple discs.
Oh, my God. And there's a third member. He's chipping in. And then finally, what was the last one?
Last one was Jeremy Pelt, Insight. I think his second album. I forget the year on this particular one.
2009, I want to say, and it was it
Crisscross,
maybe? Is it Crisscross?
I think that's right. He did one album, and then he did two on Crisscross, and a live one at Smoke. So yeah, this is his sextet.
Cool.
There you go.
So yes, all of these groups, six members. So unless you've got a different plan, I thought we'd start chronologically, maybe with Lester, because that's the shortest selection, only five songs from the Kansas City Six.
So say a little bit about the provenance of this particular thing, because this is, as the kids know, the albums back then aren't really albums. They're released as 45s, right?
No. This is the 78 era.
78.
Pre-45. No, that's okay.
Pre-45. And so these are released, what? Two sides, basically, right? And there's like 85 gazillion of them. And these are, what, from his era in the Basie outfit, basically?
Right, yeah. There's some personnel here from the Basie group. This is pre-war Lester. These are some of the jewels in his small group crown. And the personnel is Lester on tenor sax, and very memorably, he's also playing clarinet, a metal clarinet. And he rarely played it on recordings, but they're just delightful. Buck Clayton on trumpet, Freddie Green acoustic guitar, Eddie Durham electric guitar, Walter Page bass, and he's memorialized in one of the songs called Paging the Devil, and Joe Jones drums. So Page and Jones, Freddie Green, all stalwarts from Basie's group. And Clayton, of course, played trumpet there.
Great. And why, you said to me that this was Desert Island stuff for you. Like, say more.
Yeah, well, this was introduced to me. Gunther Schuller, the French horn player and musicologist and composer, who I believe played on some of the Birth of the Cool sessions, wrote a couple volumes of jazz history. He got through the early jazz, and then he did a massive volume on swing. And then he ran out of steam. As far as I know, he never released a third volume of that series. I was curious to hear what he'd say about bebop. And in that massive volume, in fact, more or less the same chapter as he discusses, and we'll get to that in a minute, John Kirby, he talks about these Lester Young sides. So he kind of drew my attention to them. And what he prizes about them, and I've learned to prize, is Lester's clarinet playing. It is an amazing thing. He is tender. He's sweet. He is in tune. But there's a kind of hesitancy about the way he plays, and there's just kind of a soul to the whole proceedings that are really great. And then, of course, Clayton's in grand form, and the rhythm section is pretty much the gold standard for the period. So, again, only five songs. I don't know that Page and the Devil is a deathless masterpiece. There's a lot of bass soloing there, which is perfectly fine, but not as compelling, maybe some of the other stuff. But I just think there's kind of a groove to this group. Kind of feel to it that I really like. So it's you know, a small group jazz of the late 30s, but I think especially good stuff.
Right. Well, I'm kind of struck with the amount, it's hard to make generalizations on out of, you know, six numbers, but the trumpet work done here on with the mute in is a nice complement to the clarinet playing, I think. And there is something sort of lyrical and tender about these sides. They're very, you said hesitancy, and I think that's a good word to describe Young here. He's already, as a tenor player, he's light as a feather, and one can argue that the cool school kind of comes through him, right? But there's an even finer degree of delicacy in his playing here that, I don't know, I mean, it sounds weird to say that he's more delicate here than elsewhere, but your point was about hesitancy on the clarinet, and I think that's right. I don't know if it's because it's not his number one horn, but there's a kind of even more intensified lyrical tenderness in his playing here. So, you know, like on I Want a Little Girl, that's it's really, first of all, it's to me, kind of a very light number, but he kind of fills it with this kind of lament. He makes it seem a little more poignant and feeling than that little ditty may perhaps deserve. I'm not especially taken with the sound of this recording. I know it's, you know, silly to be complaining about stuff from the late 30s, early 40s, but, you know, the rhythm section is really muted out on this. It's you know, and that strumming guitar is not my favorite thing here. It feels like we're in a boat sort of, you know, floating down a river in a canoe every time he's playing that damn thing. And this could have been a quintet and I would have been happy, I think.
Okay.
I don't know. Did you like it? I mean, does it seem to add anything important to the proceedings to you?
It's an unusual lineup. You're absolutely right in that more common for this period would be a pianist rather than two guitars. And, you know, Green is famous as almost a subliminal member kind of thrusting the proceedings along and Basie's rhythm section for decades.
Right.
Not known as a soloist particularly. He almost never, I don't know if he ever went on record as a with any solos. So apparently if you're at one of these all-night jam sessions towards 4 a.m. when everybody had about a quart of gin, he would start soloing a bit. I don't know that I felt that strongly about him one way or another. He's, again, almost subliminal, as you say. You know, these are 78s. They are not audio masterpieces. I mean, I think I've always felt like I can hear the important things going on in these tracks fine. I mean, I think that they capture Clayton's and Young's tone very well, but yeah, the rhythm section isn't all that well served, and we'll run into that problem again in these selections. I don't know. I mean, I feel like whatever he's doing, the selection still worked very well, but I don't know that it's, if he was taken away, I'd miss him.
Okay. I'm not as thrilled by these as you are. I like them. They're really pretty. They're really pretty. But when you said Desert Island Disc, that kind of got my attention. And maybe you shouldn't have said that, because then I was thinking, really? Okay. I'll be the judge of this. And I enjoy them. I think they're great cuts. But you also have a much deeper and longer standing appreciation for all things Lester than I do. I've kind of come to Lester through you. And if you're a big Lester fan, I could see, well, you're the one who's kind of brought Lester to the podcast.
And, you know, this is where I first heard these tracks, and they're available in many versions and many reissues. But there's a series on Blue Moon, which I think is now defunct, a label out of Spain that did basically out of copyright reissues of things. And they did 5 volumes of Lester's small group recordings up to the beginning of the Verve years. And so that's kind of where I got to know a small group playing. And in some ways, he's maybe best known for playing in Basie's band. And a lot of the later stuff people have mixed feelings about because, you know, post-war, he was kind of diminished. But, yeah, I like these a lot. I think that his clarinet playing is really what elevates them for me beyond a just really good session with a small group and Lester in his prime. They're just very distinctive. He's got, I think a listener once asked us to do a special on clarinetists. And I said, well, did you have anybody in mind? He's like, no, you figure out who to do. You know, I was like, okay. And we've talked about them off and on, but yeah, I don't think we've done a show solely devoted to them. And I noticed that there are a couple, these early selections have a couple of the best known clarinetists of the period in them. Lester's not as, you know, not the best known, but I think his approach is one of my favorites. And whether that has to do with the fact he's playing this cheap, odd metal clarinet, I mean, most clarinets are wood, I don't know, but it's just, it's like every note he has to kind of push a little harder to get it to come out. Now, when it does, it just seems beautifully centered. You know, he's just got the intonation and the tone is beautiful, but there's always, like you said, that hesitancy that kind of the notes kind of creep out just slightly late. And that seems to give a certain poignancy to it to me. I don't know. But again, this was partially influenced by Gunther Schuller, who raved about these. And so, you know, for those of us who don't spend large portions of our life listening to pre-war jazz, it's nice to have kind of people pointing you to places because, you know, I just don't have the energy to sit down and listen to, I don't know, 30 hours of pre-war small group jazz in a row or something. You know, I don't spend most of my time there.
Right, right.
Okay, well, are we ready to move on?
Let's move on. You should mention, though, on that, there's a whole bunch of, there's what, three volumes of the Lester Young that you took that from?
You know, you can slice up the cake any way you want. Blue Moon had five discs.
Okay.
And then six of alternates. And basically, they got into the Verve era. Now, Verve has done a complete box set of Lester's stuff on Verve, and that goes further chronologically. And there's some great music on there and some very painful sessions that really are marginal as to whether they should have been released. I mean, they may hurt his reputation more than anything. But the thing is, before that, he is just all over the place. You know, Keystone and Commodore and just a lot of these little labels that, you know, don't have extensive holdings and were not carefully curated. And, you know, a label like Blue Moon that's ignoring copyright because it's expired can kind of just put them in chronological order rather than, you know, bowing to one label or another's output. And I think for this kind of music, that's probably the best way to consume it rather than, you know, I used to have an album of Keystone recordings by Lester Young that would have like three alternates of a song in a row.
Right.
And I love Lester, but I don't want to hear him play the same song three times in a row.
Right, right, right. It's like those Parker, like the Parker
except
compilation.
The Parker's about, Charlie Parker's about the only, it is absolute prime on Dial, on Savoy. He's so good, I don't mind it. And that's about it. Otherwise,
right. But it's hard to listen to. It's hard to listen to four of those takes.
It is. It really is. And they're not meant, I don't know. I mean, they don't work right. That way. And of course, Lester's known, as we've said before, for sides he cut with Billie Holiday. And of course, as I said, with Basie. And this set did not include the stuff he did with Holiday, even though those really are small group jazz. They focused on stuff that he was nominally leading with no vocals. So.
All right. Cool.
So anyway, the next selection, I just thought of this as one of the, at least in its time, most famous sextets, John Kirby. And, you know, I'd forgotten entirely what Gunther Schuller had to say about Kirby, but it occurred to me about a week ago, well, I should go look and swing because probably there's a place that actually talks about this group. Gunther Schuller hates the fuck out of these guys. He just...
Really?
Oh my God, he just despises them.
Because they're not swing or what?
Well, we'll get into it. It's complicated. I think it partially has to do with the fact that, like Art Tatum, who he also kind of attacks, which I've always found just kind of bizarre, they played light classics as jazz.
Right.
And Gunther, who was...
And there's a reason for that. Like, there's a legit reason. Yeah,
right.
All right, go ahead.
Was deeply invested in this idea of third stream music, a merging of jazz and classical. And so this was like a red flag to this guy who thinks it's exactly what you should not do. Third stream is nothing like jazzing the classics. It is a much more serious enterprise where you have a hybrid, not one music kind of taking the Mickey out of another. And that's my theory anyway, but because I don't know about you, but these, you know, we listened to the first disc, basically Kirby's sextet, known as the littlest big band in the land or something, was a big popular draw for a couple of years, right around the start of World War II. And then it, you know, the war and everything interfered and he never really quite recovered that fame. He had taken over. He's a bass player. Charlie Shavers, one of the three guys that Dizzy Gillespie warned other trumpet players about as being one of the baddest motherfuckers on the planet. He just said, you know, don't mess with Charlie Shavers. Trumpet player, and Charlie also did most of the arrangements. Buster Bailey's on clarinet, Russell Prokope on alto sax, and Russell later has a long stint as a lead alto in Duke Ellington's band. Johnny Hodges obviously was the major alto soloist, but in terms of just leading the ensemble, that was Russell. Billy Kyle on piano and O'Neill Spencer on drums. So this sextet had a fair amount of fame and popularity around 1930-1940. And I don't know what you thought of them. I still find their music kind of enjoyable.
Yeah, so this stuff isn't all the classical stuff, is it, on this disc? I mean, there's a couple of things, but there's a bunch of...
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's not all they did. I mean, that's one thing they did, but they absolutely have a lot of jazz standards and just kind of popular songs.
Did you talk about why, you know, they had to go, where they went to the standards in the first place? There was a reason for that. It had to do supposedly with, I was just looking this up, it had to do with a bunch of music... Was how did this go? I was just looking at this.
Okay, the publishers.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a period there where there was a ban on playing modern music that was registered with one of the copyright holders. And so people turned to, I can't remember if it was both ASCAP and what the other one is, begins with a B.
BMI.
But in any case, because of this ban on playing this music, musicians look to out of copyright things like old classics. And for instance, one reason Mercer Ellington writes several songs during the very early 40s is that Ellington could not record his current music due to this ban. And so he had Mercer write some stuff. And of course, the question's always been whether that was actually Dukin or another name or whatever, but that was a way of getting new material during this period of time. So yeah, they do some classics, you know, Chopin's Fantasy Impromptu, the Minute Waltz, which they credit to Chopin and Shavers. You know, well, he was helping. Humoresque. You know, just Serenade by Schubert. You know, so some of these are classics jazzed up. Others of them are originals. Shavers writes a number of originals. Yeah, you're right. I mean, there are a couple like Blue Skies as a standard, but a lot of these are not what we think of as a Great American Songbook or something.
Yeah, they go pretty far back. Royal Garden Blues, Sweet George Brown, those things go back a ways, right? So I'm kind of struck here with the thing you said about them being the biggest or the smallest big band in the world or whatever. That's almost entirely due to Prokop and Bailey, isn't it? They sound really good together. I'm struck on, particularly on the slower numbers, but also on the faster ones, but especially on the slower stuff, right? Dawn on the Desert. They kind of intertwine and play off each other really nicely. And when they're playing in unison, they sound like more than two guys. It sounds like, you know, an Ellington woodwind section almost, right? So that they seem to be more than the number of guys who's actually playing. I like their synergy a whole bunch. I like those two players together a great deal. And I knew about Prokop and Ellington's band, but I don't think of him as the big featured alto player. You know, that's Johnny Hodges, right?
Right, so, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, and so, I mean, he was there forever, and surely I've heard him and I'm aware of him on many, many numbers, but it's just not a name that I always think of as like the big highlight of the Ellington band. But he's terrific here. I like him quite a bit. Same beef I have with the Lester Young sides. I have to get out the big boy headphones and turn it up really high to get any sense of the rhythm section. And that's just kind of a thing on older recordings anyway. It's just difficult. And a lot of what the drummer is doing on these kinds of things is kind of, you know, shuffle. They're not doing anything particularly thrilling.
Yeah, he's not dropping
drums.
Yeah, it's kind of just merrily as we go. And, you know, Ellington was unusual in that he loved bass players and was able to get, like Blanton, recorded in a way that he was vividly present, even in the big band stuff. But very few musicians were able to get the right kind of engineering to capture that going on.
Yeah, so the rhythm is just tough to hear. There are some breaks hither and yon, and you'll hear some things. But yeah, this is about Shavers, Bailey, and Procope.
Sounds like a law firm to me.
It does. And I happen to like Bailey's playing. He's a pretty brisk fellow. And, you know, maybe it's useful to compare him to Lester Young on the other recording. There's no hesitancy here. He's bubbly and quick and seems in full command of his instrument. There's no thinking, in a sense. I mean, that sounds wrong. But I mean, he plays with aplomb and with speed throughout. So I kind of like him a lot here. Are you a big fan of Charlie Shavers? Are you a big Shavers fan?
Well, he is clearly very technically accomplished. And I think that was part of this band's reputation, is they are playing lightly and sprightly, quickly, very well coordinated, tight as they can be. I guess Shavers had a second life as kind of a blaster at Jazz at the Plaza.
Exactly. Or Jazz at the Philharmonic.
I'm sorry. Thank you. Jazz at the Philharmonic. Exactly. Yeah.
He absolutely does.
And there he's kind of a showboater, right?
Yeah.
Kind of
tastes loud. Yes. That's exactly right. He and Buddy Rich are made for each other.
There you go. And so here it's funny to hear him muted or playing, tightly focused, sharp lines, and apparently also doing all these, borderline cute arrangements. Which, again, if you just have music to work to, or just generally a pleasant, well-polished surface that still has some content, I think this is fairly successful. I mean, it is not Desert Island music for me. It's not something I listen to a lot. I think you could argue there is a lack of ultimate soul behind it. There's not tons of feeling, right? Mm. It's more music of entertainment and wit rather than, passion.
Would you say that the modern jazz quartet before the modern jazz quartet?
Well, but with a hell of a lot more get up and go sometimes, right?
Yeah, they've got some bump, yeah.
And they never make the drummer play the triangle for 10 minutes straight, so you just want to kill yourself and everyone else in the room. Yeah, there is some, you're absolutely right in that there's a third stream, not the good third stream, the naughty third stream. Obviously, Lewis is thinking much more carefully and in a way that I think would be more Gunther Schuller approved about this blending. But there is that sense of it's presentable music. The corners have been polished off. There are some nods to the quote-unquote classical tradition. It is not trying to scare anybody. It's not trying to be avant-garde. I would say that just but it's got that kind of 30s happy cartoon pep to it that, and I like this. I listen more often to the modern jazz quartet, but sometimes it can get a little bit mired down, and that doesn't happen here. I mean, this is all very kind of streamlined, fast moving stuff. I mean, there are some mood pieces. I kind of liked Dawn of the Desert. I don't know,
I liked it too. That's what I was saying. I think that Bailey and Procope play well together. They sound like more than two guys.
Yeah, it's a sort of Albert Eiler for that matter, but
that's
just him. But it's an oddity, and in a way, I value Schuller in that he cares that much. I mean, he literally seems angry at this group, and it's like, wow, because for me, to some degree, post or pre-war jazz is, except for the very, very best of it, is a little arm's length. And of course, for many, many people, all jazz is that way. It's that old music that, makes me feel nostalgic, or, they don't have any sense of it as a living thing. It's this ancient, ossified genre, but I'm a little bit that way with pre-war jazz. It takes me a while to think my way into the headspace unless it's just something that really stands out from the crowd. And there's a little bit of that with this, but it's fun. As I said, again, sprightly, there's some humor in it. It's certainly accomplished. I mean, they certainly can play. This would not be easy, I think, for many contemporary musicians to pull off, if they just sat down to play these arrangements. Now, I've never heard, have you ever heard Don Byron's Bug Music? I mean, we've got some Byron in our
collection. I've got a pile of Byron, but I don't have that. What is that?
Apparently, he does some Kirby arrangements.
Really?
So he was, you know, nodding to them. And you know, Byron's always had a little bit of, I don't know, stiffness or third stream in him. You know, there's some stuff I like by him, some stuff that does not do it for me. I kind of got to the point three or four recordings in when I decided I wasn't going to pursue that avenue further. I'm now really curious to hear that, you know, to see what he does. Yeah. And again, you know, he's somebody who's finding and validating it as opposed to our historian friend who just really, you know, he thinks that the Kansas City Six are some of the greatest music ever made. And this is apparently Satan's left hand. So, you know, but worth, you know, if you're curious, stream a little bit of this. As I said, I think that probably I certainly could not listen to all two discs in a row and even one sometimes at some point. I'm tired of that much cheer. You know, I need something a little different. But
you want something in a minor key.
There you go. There are exceptions, as you know, again, Dawn of the Desert. But for the most part, it's kind of hitchity-chitchity kind of stuff. But that's kind of cool. And it was something that just struck me. It's like, oh, yeah, that's the sextet. We can talk about them. Okay. That'll work. So let's see. I guess I'm – are we still – No. We've got to go get some eye and ear control with our friend Albert.
So yeah, so this is not officially an Albert Eiler disc, but it might as well be. So this was a this is an ESP. Well, it's with the Calibre label, but somehow that's associated with ESP. I don't quite get the how that all works there.
Sounds like ESP to me.
It sure does. So this is Albert Eiler on tenor, as if you couldn't guess. And then Don Cherry on playing pocket trumpet and cornet here. And then John Chakai, a player I don't think we've ever talked about, but a player who's part of the free jazz movement. So he plays alto here. Roswell Rudd, we've had him. We did a thing with him and Steve Lacy.
Yes, we did. Yes, absolutely. Yeah,
so he's here on trombone. Gary Peacock, longtime bass player for Jarrett. And then Sonny Murray on drums. So this is a sextet, and yeah, it's got some pretty cool. I have this CD, so it's got some pretty amazing. The booklet is pretty thorough. It has a lot to say about all these guys, and it has a lot to say about ESP. Unfortunately, about half the thing is ESP talking, and they even include the Penguin Guide to Jazz. They include the Penguin's review, right?
Oh, wow. And, okay.
Yeah. So here, let me just, I'll read it to you. It's very short, and you can tell me if you agree. According to the Penguins, this is a 3.5-star recording. Quote, "It isn't strictly an Eiler album, but a collaborative soundtrack project for Michael Snow's now forgotten film of the same name." So this actually started as a soundtrack. "It would have been interesting to hear Eiler work with another trumpeter, particularly one who contributed so much to Ornette Coleman's music, but Don Cherry is having an off day. It's Roswell Rudd who surprises, and the slightly diffident John Chakai who steals most of the honors." Chakai's name is spelled T-C-H-I-C-A-I, so I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly.
And he played with, like, Artie Shep, too, and I don't know.
Yes.
I think of him as just, yeah, exactly, a guy in that kind of 60s scene.
Yep. So, them's fighting words for you, aren't they? They shit on John Cherry. They said Don Cherry's having a bad day. Do you think that's true?
What I've realized is that, you know, by 1965, when this was released, recording had been completely fixed since 1939, so you can hear everything clearly. I'm kidding. This is a disaster. Sonically.
Yes. So, do you agree with that verdict that Rudd is wonderful and Cherry sucks on this particular outing?
I guess I don't feel like I remember much from Cherry at all. My point about the recording quality is that the bass, and I put enormous, I've got these ridiculous, stupid-looking headphones, and I put them on, you know, trying to figure out, and the bass and the drums, to some degree, are really buried.
Yep.
And most of the time, Peacock is bowing the bass.
Yes.
So that makes it even more of a, because this is kind of, to characterize this, would you say it's fair to say that this is an ongoing kind of group improvisation? Occasionally a horn will step forward, but most of the time they're playing simultaneously. And, you know, people will sometimes compare it to Free Jazz by Ornette Coleman or Ascension by John Coltrane, because it's a bigger group playing in the style, you know, kind of early days for avant-garde music. But it's hard to hear what's going on. I mean, Eiler's always there with his enormous braying vibrato. You can hear John, the alto player, fairly frequently. And Rudd steps up, I think, like the first main track. He steps up about 10 minutes in and gets a little bit of a blast. And you hear him commenting in the background. I don't know, Cherry. I guess one way of looking at this is his kind of delicate, melodically focused playing works best in a sparse context, right? In the Ornette Coleman Quartet, normally when he's soloing, it's just Hayden and the drummer behind him.
Right.
Here, he's trying to fight his way through five other players, and I just don't think he's in the context to make an impression. What do you think of Cherry?
Well, so half and half. So I think it's half true that he can't do the kinds of things he does on Free Jazz with Ornette Coleman because it's a different... It's a different setting. And so, yes, he is sort of fighting his way through. But he is fighting his way through. So he's not absent here. It's just that the kinds of things that one associates with Don Cherry on some of his own more celebrated recordings, he's not able to do here. Because he is a player of some delicacy, a certain amount of refinement. There's a kind of reticence about him. And this is not a reticent affair. If you want to be heard... You're gonna have to blow at 11, and blowing at 11 he can do. It's just that that's not his strong suit, and it's really clear that Eiler and Chikai are in hog heaven. They're, you know, this is perfect for Eiler. He loves this setting, and he can do this all day standing on his head. And my sense is that Cherry has to kind of, it's a struggle to be heard. He is heard. It's just that I don't think what we hear from him reminds us of the kinds of things he gets up to on his own discs. There's a kind of puckish sense of humor, and this is not humorful. There's no humor here. This is just, you know, balls to the wall, peel the paint off the studio walls.
I mean, I would argue it's a little more discursive and occasionally almost mournful sounding than, say, Nailed with Cecil Taylor that we talked about a while back.
Or Machine Gun. No, that's true. That's a good point. Discursive, well, I'll just say quieter. There are quieter passages.
There you go.
Just discursive sounds meditative and like communicating. And there are some, especially toward the close of Numbers, we get sort of lilting, sort of lyrical wails and moans, overlapping wails and moans from the horns. And that seems fair. But yeah, even there, you really kind of hear Cherry kind of sprawling. And it's just not characteristic of, I can't claim complete familiarity with his discography, but on the discs that I know of him and that I like a great deal, that's not really what he's known for, and that's not his strong suit. As I said, this is, you know, It's not credited to Eiler, but I think of this as an Albert Eiler date, because this is just, this is right in his wheelhouse. This is him at his, you know, happiest. This, he must be in a very good place during this recording date. And this is the only disc I have with John Chikai on it, I think. I may have him playing with Shep or someone else.
Yeah, there's like a New York Contemporary 5.
I do have that.
Is he on that? I think. Okay. Don't hold me to that. I feel like he might be. I think I've got him on a couple odds and ends. I don't think I've got a work led by him. But yeah, right. It's a very group in theory that should be very democratic. And I think that half of the fault's got to be laid at the engineers, if there was one. It is this kind of music. I've said it many times before, the avant-garde energy music, it really requires the best engineering you can possibly get if you want to hear what people are doing. And they just don't, there is no equality here. It's a weirdly spread out sound, like, you know, one horn will be in the far left speaker and one in the right speaker. And then it's layered. You know, there's like a front line of Eiler and sometimes Cherry. Most of the time, Rudd, I feel like, is back in the second or third row and the alto player. And then the way in the back, sonically speaking, you've got the drums and the bass. And I'm sure they're playing interesting things. You just can't hear them.
Yeah.
And, you know, with something like Spiritual Unity, with Eiler's playing there with, I think it's the same drummer. I'm pretty sure it's Peacock. We talked about that album at length.
That's his trio. That's his working trio.
And of course, their ESP was equipped to kind of do a better job of capturing everybody. It's just a simpler assignment. It's just easier to get three voices down on tape than six. And here they just seem a bit overwhelmed. And so, it just doesn't come out well sonically.
There's some stuff here that is worth telling you, I guess, about New York ear and eye and ear control. So it is a soundtrack. Only the first cut, which is a minute long, is really scored, composed. The other two are pretty much fully improvised in studio. But they're related. This is related to a disc by Paul Blay called Barrage. And on the cover of Paul Blay's disc Barrage, you can see stills of a woman walking, and those are stills taken from this movie. And in case you were wondering, the stills of that woman walking are Carla Bley.
Ah, yes, yeah.
And I might as well tell you this too, then, because this will explain a lot. This was not recorded in a studio. Surprise, surprise. It was recorded in a poet's loft, and they actually had to drill holes in the floor to feed the microphone cables out of the room. So if it sounds like it's a shit recording, there's a reason for that. It is a shit recording.
Yeah, it does sound that way, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's just kind of problematic. But yeah, there are these some stills on my cover art for this. There's some stills, and it's in silhouette, but presumably that's Carla Bley. So you couldn't tell by looking at it.
No, it's just, a female figure. But yeah,
a female figure, but that's Carla Bley, go figure, from outtakes of the film.
Okay. Yeah. And the tracks, you know, there's one very short track, two tracks, roughly around 20 minutes each, and all of them just kind of stop. You know, there isn't, it's like they just, all right, turn off the tape. There is a quieting. There is the energy slowly kind of simmers down at the end of both the long tracks, but there isn't a conclusion. There's kind of just an abrupt cessation.
Right.
So it's a unpolished gem. Again, I think the playing on it's of a fairly good level. It's just that it's hard to get it, to hear it. So, and of course it's very intense atonal music, you know, it's not pleasant background listening, though, to be honest. I think partially because of the sonics, if I turn it on pretty soon, I just start like ignoring it, because it's like, oh, those boys are just making their noise again, you know, and I kind of, you know, I'd have trouble focusing unless I really bore down and suck the headphones on or something. And again, I think that's partially to do with just not capturing the event very well on tape.
So how did Joyce classify it? Was it Wubba 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 or?
Well, in the interest of celebrating our 30th anniversary next year, I did not play this to her. I listened to it at my desk. I listened to it in my headphones, but I did not played out in the living room. That seemed to be pushing things a bit. So
you wanted to preserve your marriage.
And I thought maybe a little longer would be a good idea. And I don't know, I'm guessing is less organized and maybe for the better than like a free jazz where there's kind of a sequence of solos. The difference being, again, that free jazz and Ascension, so much of avant-garde music of this type is about texture and micro events and just kind of things unfolding in real time and listening to all the different voices together. And it's a little harder to pick those up here. But, you know, interesting playing. I mean, I agree. Eiler's in a good spot. And, you know, it's a good group. Lord knows. It's all big names. And they're all playing well. But I just wish I could hear them better.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. Well, that was I actually picked that as pure revenge for your throwing in a third disc. So,
well, you know, like I said, after the experimental, there's very little. My one recommendation of Pop Matters is going to be even stranger. So I guess the next one up would be Two Flowers on a Stem.
Okay.
Yes, that must be it. So we've talked about, especially I have raved about Black Saint and Soul Note, you know, the labels of the 80s that were kind of, I felt like the cutting edge of the time and released a lot of music I loved. And this is a project by John Jang, the piano player. And it's the only album by him I own, and I have not followed his career. But he puts together a sextet on the Soul Note label and is playing a blend of Chinese and American idioms. The group is comprised of, again, Jang on piano, James Newton on flute, and I've raved about James before, David yep. Murray on tenor sax and bass clarinet, Billy Hart drums, Santi Tribiano bass, and I'm sorry, Chen Jibing?
Chen Jibing.
Jibing, thank you. On
Plain.
A two...
Erhu.
yes, yeah, right, Erhu, a two-stringed Chinese violin that is played cello style vertically. And that gives this session a very distinctive flavor, right? You
yep.
hear that sound and you think China. And they play a mix of originals by Jang and a cover of a traditional piece. And then really kind of one of the centerpieces of the album is an almost 20-minute long performance of Meditations on Integration by Charles Mingus. And Mingus was certainly a figure that loomed large for both James Newton and David Murray. And Newton does his own version of that song on one of his albums. So thoughts about Two Flowers on a Stem from 1996. John
Jay. So there are certain players who we both love and who we both just think if you include them, nothing can go wrong. And James Newton is kind of on that short list. He's inspired casting here, I think. And I do think he's the standout. And that's saying something because David Murray is no slouch, especially on bass clarinet. I always love it when he goes to other horns, and I really like his playing on bass clarinet. The showstopper is Meditations on Integration, isn't it? And it has some wonderful unison passages and then some like planned chaos. I don't know how to put it, sort of planned freakouts kind of in the middle. I love the bass clarinet against the flute on that song. They just it's a great sound. And that eerie Chinese string instrument in the back sounds great. It's just right. It's those two horns with that string accompaniment behind them just make a lot of sense. It just sounds really good. And I also have to say, Billy Hart, who can be an extrovert big time, seems very thoughtful and restrained here and really contributes to the proceedings. I'm not saying that his being an extrovert is a bad thing. I'm just saying I can think of him on some of his own recordings. And he's not our Blakey, but he's loud. He's busy. And he's here. He's very much part of what's happening here. The drums are kind of integrated, especially the cymbal work that he does on Meditations. So they're really integrated into the flow of that song. And I can't say enough about how that song kind of comes in and out of focus. Like, there are moments where there are these unison passages, and it's, this happens a lot in that song, in that 20 minutes. And then they break into little cells of freak out, and then they return back to sort of ensemble playing throughout that song. It's an interesting take on the song, and I like it a lot. They don't quite pull Mingus like Taffy. I can still hear Mingus. You know, I can still hear the original in my head when I listen to it, so that's kind of cool. But the instrumentation is quirky and odd enough to be endlessly interesting. And Newton is just such a wonderful presence. He just doesn't do anything bad. He's such a fine player. He can do so many different things.
And he plays sometimes in a kind of quasi-Asian idiom anyway, right? I mean, that's one of the streams of influence on his playing, so kind of brings
that
out.
He can make the flute scream. He's one of the guys who will do that, and it doesn't sound bad. It's like if John Coltrane could do multiphonics with a flute, it would sound like this. It's pretty cool. So, yeah, for me, that's the best song. I like that song a lot, and I listen to that particular cut, you know, more times. The rest of it's good. I don't dislike it. I'm not slighting the rest of it. I think it's quite fine. But that was a really inspired take on Mingus. I thought that was really smart. On the numbers where Murray plays saxophone, it's not that I dislike it. I like it less well than when he's on bass clarinet. I like the numbers with him on bass clarinet here better. I think the interaction with Newton is more interesting on those numbers. So, like Eleanor Bumpers, he goes to the horn, and he goes to tenor. It's good.
It's good, that kind of Ben Webster, Albert Eiler cross that he loves so much, right? You know, the kind of romantic.
He's some sort of woozy, heavy vibrato, you know, yeah. And Newton kind of fades into the background there. And I'm like, I want more James. Bring back the bass clarinet. So, yeah, this is a good disc. And this has been on my want list forever. And so it was cool to, you know, finally get it and listen to it for this occasion. I don't know anything about this piano player. And no diss to him. He's just not the most interesting thing here. In fact, he's the least interesting thing here. Of all the things here that are interesting, all of which are plus, he is the smallest plus in my mind.
Yeah, I mean, he's...
There's no way to say this without sounding like an insult. It's just that everyone else is so good. I like everyone else.
Yeah, well, they don't really... Dude, this is not a feature for him instrumentally. And he comes out and he'll play some passages. The other really long piece that I thought is actually really interesting as well is that Variations on a Sorrow Song.
Mm-hmm.
And that one runs almost 15 minutes or 16 minutes. And it's a little bit more whiplash between Chinese idiom music and then more straight ahead jazz. I mean, there's a lot of morphing there. Yeah, this is an album with three really long performances, the longest being Meditations. It almost goes 20 minutes, and then three performances that are around the 5 or 6 minute mark. So it's interested in, you know, he's interested in developing and arranging and kind of extended performances that have a lot of parts to them, and then he'll do more focused stuff. You know, the one thing I'll say is that I did notice this time that Murray's incessant slap tonguing, which is kind of, you kind of suck on the reed and then pop it off. both on bass clarinet and tenor. It's an old style technique that like Coleman Hawkins used in his, you know, early years. And I'm not really sure it needs to be brought back. You know, I don't know that, you know, and some I've played like an avant-garde piece years ago that required that for a few bars, you know, as a kind of a special effect, but he does it more than I'd like, I guess. But yeah, otherwise that rich, fruity, woody bass clarinet is great. It is a, you know, smashingly good group. I don't know that finally it's quite the Stone classic I wish it was. I think it probably got a little additional kudos at the time because it was cross-cultural, because it had this ambition of, you know, merging these musical ideas. And I think it does a good job with it, but I just think it's maybe, you know, one degree off from being, you know, real, one of my favorite Desert Island Soul Note or Black Saint discs.
Yeah.
But it's good.
It is. It is good. And thanks for bringing it finally to my attention. I like it quite a bit.
Okay, next up would be it's the Bar Kokba. I like to say Kokba Sextet 2003. To talk a little bit about one of the many ways Mr. Zorn celebrated his birthday.
Yep. I got this through a music trading site, amazingly. I got the whole damn, so this was, you know, a trade. Three discs, beautiful, beautiful book setup. It's a glorious three-disc set. It was in pristine condition, and I can only imagine one of two things happened. Someone gave this to someone saying, you like John Zorn, you'll love this. And they listened to it, they're like, this isn't John Zorn. Or or they said, you should try John Zorn, you'll love this. And they listened to it, they're like, what the fuck? If you're looking for John Zorn's angry, squalling, hyperactive, hyperkinetic alto, it ain't here. So on this 50th birthday celebration, apparently they like squatted in some club for 30 days and nights or whatever, and different groups, some including Zorn and some not including Zorn, play Zorn's music, and they recorded every fucking thing. And so
of
there
course
are
they did.
30 or 31 of these. And so this is one of the nights. So yeah, it has like, I don't know how many volumes. The 50th birthday celebration has 31, 32. I don't know how many volumes. It's got a lot. And this, you know, as I said, many volumes have multiple discs. So this is a three disc set, and it's John Zorn's music. And if I've reached the point in listening to Zorn that I actually know some of the damn tunes, like I've heard them enough where I know Kibar or Kabar. I know that song. Like when I hear the first chords, I'm like, I know this. There's a handful of John Zorn compositions in this medium that I know. And that when I hear them in with different groupings, I know the melody. So there is a melody here. There is a melody here, but this will make people happy. If you find John Zorn a little too acerbic or stringent or rebarbative or whatever for your taste, try this disc, the Bar Kokba Sextet. It's a string sextet. A string sextet, class. How can you go wrong? What could be bad about that? Joey Barron's here on drums, so there's that. Actually, let me grab the disc real quick, and I'll remind you of the personnel, because I don't remember it off the top of my head. I knew several of them, but I didn't remember a couple. So it's a good thing I went and got the disc. So it's Mark Ribot on guitar, Mark Feldman on violin, Eric Friedlander on cello, Greg Cohen on bass, who does a lot of bass work with Zorn and some of his groups, Joey Barron on drums, and then Ciro Baptista on percussion. So that's your sextet, and apparently Zorn was conducting.
I love it.
So he was present and telling people what to do.
Because it's funny, if you listen to it, it doesn't seem like really elaborate. It's not like Zappa or something. It's mostly kind of Kochot, I don't know, K-O-C-H-O-T.
Mm-hmm.
That song to me has some resemblance to Temptation. Thank you. which the Kirby group played. You know, there's a kind of da-da-da-da-da-da, which I assume Temptation was kind of playing with those harmonies.
Right.
But most of it, there is at least one tune where kind of they get fairly freaky and they get a little closer to Eilerland.
Right.
But most of these are kind of groovy, I don't know, Middle Eastern or ethnic sounding jams, you know.
Well, I think we need to stick with Judaism here. I think we need to be really clear about what's happening. So a lot of these guys play in his group Masada. You call your group Masada and you're signaling something, right?
I guess my point is that is me not being quite as immersed in Judaism as Mr. Zorn.
Yes.
If I heard these, I wouldn't necessarily say, yes, the Jewish masterpiece X, you know, absolutely, of course, yeah, this has become an increasingly important part of his identity and his self-presentation and his music, and we've all got some, I think every man and woman and child in America has at least one Masada disc. They don't know where it came from, they don't know what it is, they never played it, there's just so many of them, they just is like, what is this, mommy, it's just a coaster, it's fine, don't put it in the CD player, son, you'll get hurt.
Yeah.
But this is really, because I was wondering, you said, oh God, a John Zorn sextet. What is this going to be? Because it could have gotten real ugly.
And see, I was nice to you. I was nice.
There you go. Thank you. And, you know, I think I enjoyed this the most when I was in the living room and I cranked it up on the stereo, and the energy and the percussion and the rhythm there came through best. And it is pretty well recorded, and it sounds good, and it's scintillating, you know, especially for a live recording. I'm very impressed. So it's just pleasant to listen to for the most part. And it's not like the freak out numbers are just hell on earth or something, but there's a couple where they get a lot more out. And some of this, I'm like, it's not quite wedding music or something, but you know, you can imagine a group playing some of these songs at a dance or just a social function and people not freaking out, you know, it would be fine.
Yeah, I thought it might be fun just to tell you the names of some of the other groups that played on the other
and
the rest of the month. Yes. So on Monday, the first, they had Hemophiliac. On Tuesday, there was a group called Duras Duchamp. On Wednesday, Cobra. Thursday was the Masada String Trio. Friday, the 5th, was his group Painkiller, who also were held over for Saturday. On Sunday, they did the string quartets. On the 8th, that was the Milford Graves John Zorn duo. On the following Tuesday, it was live music to underground films. On Wednesday, it was a group called Locus Solus and something called Fencing Hu Di Huang Chini.
You know, after a point, I'm like, guys, what you need to do is go to a fucking Ponderosa and stop being so goddamn downtown New York.
I mean, and, you know, you have to imagine a lot of these guys.
These are
all guys who know him, right? So this group's Mark Kokba, Fred Frith, John Zorn duo, Masada guitars. Masada played his thrash punk rock band Kristallnacht, played the Susie Ibarra John Zorn duo, the Wadato Leo Smith John Zorn duo played. Electric
Great Golf Courses of America. I know, that's what it was.
Electric Masada. And of course, they had an improv party, because none of that was improv before that. So, and these are, you know, like I said, there's like 30 of these things, but each of these has, many of them have multiple discs, and apparently they're great collector's items. I have the one, I might have one of the Masada sets. I may have one of those somewhere.
You're going to get the whole 50th birthday bash box. It probably comes
in its own celebrate my 50th birthday with this intensity, but anyway, I dig the hell out of this. I think it's a lot of fun, and I also think it sounds like a cool soundtrack to like a comedy about a cross-cultural romance, crossed stars romance in Palestine and Israel, right? You know, it has this kind of peppy.
You cannot make a movie called Crazy Rich Jews. That's just offensive. It's okay for Asians, not so much.
But I mean,
playing into stereotypes,
it has
can't
this
do that.
Kind of peppy, brisk.
Oh yeah.
Feel it's up. There's a lot of major key stuff here. It's fun. This is not agony or, you know, strife. It's peppy stuff. And just, I love anything with Joey Barron. Joey Barron's always fun. So, and he's terrific here, of course. So, yeah, I like this a lot. I hope you liked it. I hope it didn't hurt you too much.
Oh, yeah. As I said, I think that I got the most out of it fairly loud, where I could hear, especially, as I said, the rhythms are great.
Yeah.
And, you know, not that the top line isn't good either, but just that kind of gave it that extra layer of complexity that added interest to what are fairly straightforward tunes. You know, these are not, again, you know, I keep saying it's not Zappa. This is not 15 part, 13 section, 47 key change, 13 time signature change thing. It's kind of grooving folk music.
Yeah.
But, you know, played at a very high level. When I put it, you know, on at work or whatever, I liked it. But again, due to its percolating nature and the fact that really, I don't feel like this is a showcase for showboating.
No.
Pyrotechnic soloist, right? It's kind of
no, not
they're
at all.
There. There's some, but it's not kind of the reason for the music.
No.
Yeah. You know, it's not about, yeah.
You have the sense that it made sense that there was a conductor. You know, because right. This is very through composed for the most part.
I mean, it's not like Eddie Joe Beam on Out of the Blue by Roxy Music, where it's like, you know, he just kind of owns the last 2 minutes of that song. And it's all about the electric violin. I mean, this is kind of more, it's part of what's going on, but it's more about the groove.
Yeah.
So, yeah. It's pleasant, fun music. Certainly people I never heard of. And then I looked them up and said, okay, well, I've heard of some of these musicians, but there are just so many various groups that rotate around the sun that is John Zorn, that keeping track of them is beyond me. You know, there's just so many ensembles that he's kind of spawned.
Yeah. So anyway, I'm glad you liked it. And yeah, it's a sextet. So there you go.
There you go. Six people. Tell us about your final selection by trumpeter Jeremy Pelt, who I've got to confess, I know I don't have any leader dates by him. I don't know if I've heard the guy before or not.
Really? I thought for some reason, okay, well, that's fine. I can't remember how or where I came across him. I thought you turned me on to him. I guess that's not true. I have three things by him, and this was the earliest of the things I have by him. I know very little about him. The Penguins say he reminds them of Lee Morgan and Donald Byrd. I don't know if that works for you. I'm not sure Lee Morgan works for me.
No.
Yeah, I don't think so either. So Insight is a 2002 date. Pelt on trumpet, Jimmy Green on soprano and tenor, Myron Alden on alto, Rick Germanson on keyboards, Vicente Archer on bass, and the only person I've heard of, Ralph Peterson on drums.
Okay.
So that's your sextet. I have a two-disc set of him playing live at a club called Smoke. I feel like I should know where that is, but I don't off the top of my head. Anyway, how did you like this? This is your first crack at Jeremy Pelt.
I was thinking we could have done an alternate version of this podcast. We kind of picked fairly unusual sextets, or certainly from different idioms that were not necessarily right in the heart of the mainstream. I guess both the Young and the Kirby, John Kirby, were mainstream for their time, but they, you know, they're now kind of considered older style jazz. And then the other ensembles are kind of unusual. This is kind of the one that's right in the heart of mainstream post-bop machine tool jazz.
Yep.
So I liked it. I feel like Pelt's a pretty strong player, but I won't pretend I've got his fingerprint down or that this wasn't the kind of music that is enjoyable as it was. Didn't occasionally sink into the background for me as another example of very accomplished, good sounding and kind of burnished sounding, post-bop jazz. Not lots of surprises. I don't know that the songs, there's a couple that had a little bit more insistent rhythmic motifs, but I don't know that he strikes me as a writer who's great at grabbing your lapels and really digging into your memory. So I don't know there was any one thing about the sessions that grabbed me. I enjoyed it. I feel like he's maybe a little more fluid and confident on the trumpet than some players I've heard. I mean, even given the tough state of competition. And I wasn't entirely, I mean, I feel like that he's a little bit maybe a son of Winton. I don't know whether, not that he sounds like him, but, you know, kind of somebody who came in the wave after Winton. I don't know. What do you think of this guy?
I like him. I thought I can understand why they said Lee Morgan from the first cut, Ides of March, right? that particular cut features a lot of pretty fleet and crisp playing. But I don't know that I don't hear Lee Morgan all the time when I listen to this.
No, he's not as extroverted. He's not as humorous.
He's not puckish. He's kind of a team player. I agree with you about the compositions. I can't remember any of the melodies, and I've listened to this one the most for this week, and I don't remember the melodies for this. I just don't. I always find it pleasant playing. I like the high tempo numbers pretty well. I don't know who these saxophone players are, but I like hearing them against one another. They trade. It's fairly traditional stuff, right? Ides of March starts with, trumpet solo, and then alto solo, and then tenor solo. So you kind of go right in, it's frontline stuff, right? It's basic post-bop jazz, and they're good. At least for once, the engineering is excellent. You can hear what the drummer is doing. You can hear the bass. You can hear the piano.
Right. And that's, I'm sure partially just a reflection of its time, but even now you get badly engineered recording, so it's not like it's a slam dunk even now.
So were there any cuts that stuck out for you that were particularly wonderful or particularly not wonderful?
Not necessarily. There is like one, I say about the third in the running order, that I noticed finally kind of an insistent rhythmic pattern boring into my memory a little bit. But I listened to this a lot, too. It was the most playable, the most, again, just kind of middle of the road. And I do think that there is a kind of impersonality here. I'm hoping and assuming that as he gets older, he gets a little bit more interesting. I'm hoping. I don't know. Not that he's boring or something, but sometimes I think young players, they haven't fully formed their personalities. Now, Lee Morgan would be an exception to that. He was,
Right.
But for most musicians of a fairly young age, they don't necessarily have, they might have the technical stuff under control. But they haven't always learned to express themselves through the horn. And yeah, and I guess this idiom is kind of a little bit tamped down idiom. It's not quite, there's that period in the 90s I felt like where a lot of jazz just got really too behind glass. It was just too smoothed out. And that was my problem with one of my favorite albums now, Greg Ausby's Art Forum. I've learned to love that record. I know you never did, but I did. But the sound of it was kind of off-puttingly smooth. And there's a little bit of that here. I don't think it's overdone. I mean, Chris Cross, generally, they still fly the bebop colors. But yeah, I don't know that a single number, other than the last one, we're missing a couple minutes. So it's like rather than a little, that's just a technical issue. I don't know that any of them stood out. I mean, he does like one standard, and that's maybe, it calls back to an earlier idiom. So I guess we'll remember that. But I don't know that that convinced me that at his age during this recording, he was, necessarily going to put his thumbprint on it. I'm trying to think what the name of it is. What's the standard he does there?
I Wish You Love.
Thank you. A ballad there. And, it's good. I mean, I think the main thing about it is it's a little more quote-unquote traditional, and so it stood out for me that way.
I think, I do think maybe your Marsalis comparison is apt. It reminds me of Black Codes from the Underground a little bit. It's an early Marsalis, not the neo-trad Marsalis that he becomes later on. I can hear Black Codes here from time to time.
Yeah, well, and just general Miles Davis second great quintet influence. I mean, there's some of that going on. Don't they play one of those shorter numbers from
Sisyphus?
Madness. That's actually, I think that's a Herbie Hancock joint. It's very, that one is very much in the style of the second great quintet to a degree that, there's that sense where you get musicians who are showing, I can do this. And they're not quite to, what do I have to say about this? In other words, why are you playing Madness? You'll never play it in that idiom and that approach better than the quintet did. So what spin are you going to put on this to like justify you taking it up? Because there's 1,000 ways you could spin it and different ways of looking at the composition. but you don't want to go in there necessarily reminding me of the way the Great Quintet would play it, which is sort of what they're doing here. Again, I think it's young man syndrome. You know, it's just they're fairly young and they're showing off, because I mean, it's not like it's easy to imitate the second Great Quintet. Most musicians can't. It's just that it's difficult, but not necessarily worthy of recording. You know, it's like, it's amazing you can do it, but I don't need to hear it because I have all of Miles Davis's albums. But yeah, that was another one that I think, again, struck me as being a little bit more distinctive, but it was a distinctive imitation. So anyway, that was the other one that probably stood out.
Okay, cool.
And The Glass Room, I was hoping would have something to do with Bud Powell's glass enclosure, but as far as I can tell, it doesn't. So.
Okay.
Now there's a piece to cover.
Three is a magic number. Yes, it is. It's a magic number.
Okay. I don't know whether you got a chance. Actually, I'm pretty sure you didn't. But normally in our anniversary shows, we kind of look over the previous year and say, are there a couple tunes that are there albums we'd recommend, you know, must hears from the last year? Did you have any of those in mind that
you tell me yours and I'll remind myself of what's on the list.
Okay.
And see, yeah, go, because I have one at least, but yeah.
And that's Duke Ellington's Jerome as a Woman. I know you loved it.
Oh, can't get enough of that. Yeah.
Yeah. I will say that when I did the, I had to go solo. Mike was unable to come in. And so I did a all Duke Ellington suite one, and all of those, of course, would be up there for me. So it was a little hard. And again, I'll go through these and I enjoy almost every one we discuss. There are exceptions, but for the most part, there's always something I like out of these recordings. But at the same time, as you get older, you know, what's going to be on that relatively limited scope desert island? Maybe you've got one CD rack or two, but you can't have everything. And it's hard to get new entries on there. So an old entry, I'd say that, you know, if you haven't yet, people, listen to those early Louis Armstrong on Decacides. Those are just must-hears. You may not like all of them, but I think that, you know, you don't want to miss them. And there's so much fun to be had there. Enjoy. I guess I was, you know, thinking, do I want to say Fly or Die by Jamie Branch? And I said, I like that record. It's ambitious. It's impressive. But if I want to be honest, Yazomed's La Sabatousse is the record I'm more likely to listen to again and again. It is more mainstream, but I think that's real successful. So if you haven't picked up Yaz's La Sabatousse, I think it's a lot of fun.
No love for Thrane Hjalmarsson's The Influence of Buildings on Musical Tone?
I have very strong feelings for The Influence of Buildings on Musical Tone. Those feelings aren't love, but I have them. Yeah, if you're trying to break up with somebody, get that album. And then, you know, Strength's Effect, A Sky You Could Strike a Match On, indie product, two players, and a lot of strong melodies, a lot of fun going on there. Definitely worth hearing. If they're in your town, go listen to them. I think it's a very successful little record. Not necessarily the only ones I could have picked off the list, but three I like.
Well, so there's Desert Island, there's Favorite from this year. So lots of things that we've listened to are Desert Island. I'm surprised you didn't pick Honey and Salt, because you really liked that album a lot. That was one of your favorites.
Yeah. But anything with poetry recital is ultimately going to be on a second shelf for me, but yeah, right. I thought it worked pretty well.
And no, not the Next. Didn't care for the Next.
They're interesting. They are. I mean, I'll listen to them again. In terms of my favorite picks out of this year, no, but right. They're definitely, you know, I'll put them on again.
Well, so I wasn't there for the Ellington Sweet date, but Such Sweet Thunder is my favorite out of those. I've heard all of them except, I think, the Queen's Suite. I may have heard the Queen's Suite. Is that live in London?
They may do parts of it. I mean, it is. Okay. It literally was an album that he made for Queen Elizabeth.
Right. So it's got the Rose song on it, Two Petals or Petals on a Rose,
right,
or something.
Exactly. Yeah. That gets covered a lot. Yeah.
Gotcha. Anyway, Adore Sweet, Such Sweet Thunder. I think it's 5-star Ellington. So I'll go with that. I love the Louis Armstrong, but that's not going to be one of my five. I'm going to pick Renee Marie's Vertigo, because I love the shit out of her, and I just think everything she does is wonderful. So I'm a huge, huge fan of that. So again, obviously, it's not necessarily Desert Island stuff, right? But of the albums we did this
year. Sure, yeah.
Such Sweet Thunder, because I didn't get to talk about it. And then Renee Marie's Vertigo. And the album that I just can't not stop shaking my rump to, Red Barat's Shreggy G.
Ah.
Love that album. Just fucking love that album. I play it sometimes. I play cuts from it sometimes before lecture. Invariably, students will come up afterwards and say, what was that? You know, they're like, it's like, I rarely will play jazz. There's some jazz I'll play occasionally before a lecture. I like to play music to wake my students up. But Shreggy G just does the fucking trick. That's just the bomb. And works every time. No love for Shatner's Bassoon?
You know, that was close. it did. You know, I find that, I know you found that a little bit too structured and predictable, but I did like that quite a bit. Again, I'm trying to be honest here. I mean, what is Patrick likely to put back on rotation in the real world where he's got limited time and energy for really demanding music? You can only whip out the bassoon so often. Otherwise,
So, yeah, for me, those would be the three honorable mentions, like things that I like hearing or would like to hear more. So, I mean, South of the Border, Charlie Parker. Of the McPherson albums we looked at this year, I probably like Siku Tabibi the best. I liked probably better than you did Hypnotic Brass Ensembles, Hypnotic Joints.
Yeah, right. I
liked that. I think Binker and Moses are terrific. I liked Journey to the Mountain of Forever a great deal. And would have to pick something out of the Cecil Taylor selections. Hard to say what. Just say one would be there. One would belong. Somehow one of them would make it in.
You know, I got Silent Tongues on vinyl. And mostly if you get avant-garde vinyl, it's pristine because people played it once and said, oops. So I'm looking forward to just sitting down. That's a solo recital we didn't cover in our Cecil Taylor special, but one of his well-regarded ones, I think on Arista. And it's around because it was a pretty major label distribution, comparatively speaking, for Pretty Out Music. So I'm waiting to see if that'll become my favorite.
Okay. And honorable mention also to Hedwig Malmsteen's Black Stabat Mater, which I don't know what we call that. I don't know if we want to call it jazz.
It's rock and roll, but you like it.
It's someone thrashing the shit out of a guitar. Love that album. But yeah, I don't know what to make of that. And then, you know, the guests that we had on this year, we had some really good guests. And they were all really nice people to talk to, and they all have really interesting projects. Of all of them, I think I'm looking forward most to whatever Sarah Bernstein gets up to next. I'll be interested to see what Kevin Bales and Carrie Johnsrud do, and Glenn Kreitzer's stuff is dead interesting. But yeah, I'm really kind of eager to hear where Sarah Bernstein goes next.
Well, of course, we interviewed Charles McPherson, too, of course, and he was...
Oh, duh, yeah. I mean, but yeah, Charles.
He's no, right. He's a given.
He's a given. He's like indestructible. He just goes on and on. So, yeah, of course, Charles. But yeah, I was thinking more of like the younger people who we had. Oh yeah, so I think that's everyone we had on, right? Kreitzer. Am I leaving someone out? Who else did we have on? Anybody else?
I don't think this year.
Right. So it was Kreitzer, Kevin Bales and Carrie Johnsrud, Charles McPherson, and Sarah Bernstein.
Yeah, it was our busiest interview year. We'll see if we top it.
Yeah, no, it was nice having those people on, and it was good to, you know, it's cool to hear from. It's always good to talk to artists, especially because most of them are so just fucking thoughtful. You know, I mean, they're actually kind of reflective, thoughtful people, and you know, we got a lot of good. We got a lot of really interesting. We learned a lot of interesting stuff from all of them. You know, Charles McPherson was like terrific. So yeah, those were all people whose stuff I'm interested in. But yeah, Sarah Bernstein, I am interested in hearing what she gets up to next. So
she's most likely to swerve. We know. Yeah, we just don't know what she'll do. So that's pretty cool. Yeah, it's like,
that's
what are
true.
You up to? Any pop matters on your mind?
Let's see, what did I listen to this week or the last 2 weeks? Not so much. Tons of grading. what have I listened to that might interest you? For no particularly good reason, I had a bunch of Paul Simon sort of re-enter the rotation, which was kind of fun. Something you won't like, but the kids out there might. I have this live disc by the Buzzcocks. Have you ever heard the Buzzcocks?
I know that I've heard of them. I don't know that I've heard them.
Angry punk. Angry okay. punk.
As opposed to happy punk, yeah.
I know. This is a live date. And here's a quiz for Patrick. It's a punk album. It's a compilation, I guess, of a live date they recorded. Now, this album is 1 hour and 18 minutes long. How many songs are on it, Patrick?
Oh, my God. Punk songs? I mean, there could be 30 on there. I don't know.
That's the name of the album.
Okay.
The name of the album is 30.
Pretty damn good guess, I gotta say.
Although
it was a guess, I did not look that up. So
there's only 28 songs, but still, it's
those
all
fuckers. Okay.
I know. Anyway, yeah, I've been listening to that. That's not something I play before lecture, mainly because I don't want open rebellion. I found that there are very few things I can play that will not please someone, but punk can always be counted on to piss off everyone. So whenever I played anything punky, some punky things in the repertoire, that never goes over well. I could put on Weird Al Yankovic polka shit and some students would be like, this is awesome. You play the Buzzcocks and people are like, what the fuck? They're like, stop this. They don't want to hear it. I get complaints. Yeah, so I don't often go there. So yeah, that and then recently I was re-listening to Arctic Monkeys 2006 album, Whatever People Say I Am. That's I forget the full title. Whatever People Say I Am, That's Who I Am, Where I Am, What I Am. It doesn't matter. It's not a very good album.
It's not That's What I'm Not? Okay.
That's What I'm Not. Yeah, whatever. I like their more recent one better. So, blah,
okay.
blah.
Yeah.
What have you been listening to? You said something. You had something weird to talk about. So
yeah, so I don't know pop music. You know, I listen to old stuff and I'm still a big fan of Kate Bush's Never Forever. But the new thing that came is a review copy that has nothing to do with jazz or pop or rock or music is Paula Mathewson and Olivia Valentine's Between Systems and Grounds. And what it sounds like to me is an ambient soundtrack for a horror movie.
Okay.
It's weird. It's much more consistent in volume and density than the buildings and, you know, the influence of buildings on sound. I mean, that was, you know, that it's just half the time it's not there at all, you know, and it's less about just pure sound, but it's not exactly hummable tunes. It's more like this kind of, I don't know, synthesized noises and bleeps and whatever, but it works really well as background for reading and or writing spooky stuff or just kind of vegging. So I think it's music for use. It's likely to get played again, whereas not so much for the influence of building
yeah.
on sound. I don't know that it's quite as ambitious aesthetically. I'm not sure what it is they're doing. I think it's manipulating synthesizers or computers or telephones or something. I don't know. But, you know, it's like, okay, well, I can imagine, you know, I have, and I know it works, but this on the background and no one else is around, I'm okay. I mean, it'll freak people out who are expecting something more like music, but I kind of like it. I don't know
cool.
if that's even released yet, but when it comes out, if you like that sort of stuff, I'll play a little clip. Look them
all
up.
All right. Well, and also I got in the mail today, of all days, some fool somewhere sent me the box set of REM at the BBC, which I just loves me some fucking REM. So I'm going to guess this. I'm going to guess this was you. And thanks a lot. I can't wait to listen to this. It looks pretty cool.
It's very confusing. You know, they're different.
Really sweet box set.
Different
yeah.
versions of it. And every one is called the Best of REM at the BBC, but there's a 2-disc set and a 2 LP set, and then there's this 8 CD set. I'm like, is it the best of them at the BBC, or is it just every fucking thing they ever did? I don't know. I mean, how much were they there? Did they move in?
I suspect this is everything. The cover here says it's a compendium of live radio, TV and in-studio performances from the BBC archives. So there's stuff with them with Jules Holland on television. There's live BBC broadcasts where they were in a church at Glastonbury Festival, at Milton Keynes, in Nottingham, and then just in the damn studio. So, and there's all kinds of songs in here, some of which I don't even know. So
okay, that'd be interesting.
Pretty cool. Yeah, I'm looking forward to just giving. Apparently, they play Moon River.
Oh no.
On the DVD of the BBC television broadcast, that's their opener. So I can't wait to see what the fuck happened there.
Henry Mancini wasn't happy.
I can only imagine. Well, it depends on which REM shows up, right? You know, if it's the punksters of the very early, REM, or if it's the Brian Wilson addicts of late REM, who knows? And it's got some videos on here, which I'm looking forward to seeing. I don't know if you've seen, I think I told you, there's one video I saw that they did. I never paid much attention to videos, but there's some video, I forget which song it is, but what they did was they filmed, I think I told you this, I can't remember. They filmed, I think, only 20 seconds of video in a giant, like, Hollywood backyard, and it's like a Hieronymus Bosch painting. There's like a million things going on, but they only filmed like 20 seconds. Huh. And then what they do, the whole video is they focus in on different parts of it and run it backwards and forwards. So during the song, it looks like there's a whole narrative, but in fact, it's literally just 20 seconds all happening simultaneously. But the way they sort of move, they don't actually cut. They just sort of zoom in on one part and they run it forwards and backwards and they move to another part forwards and backwards or, just forwards or whatever. And that's the whole video. I think it's a really clever idea. I can only imagine what a fucking nightmare it was if, in fact, they got everyone on that set to do everything simultaneously for 30 seconds. Because some people are diving off a diving board in a swimming pool, and there's someone chasing a butterfly with a gnat, and, there's like just a whole bunch of shit. So if they did that, or if that's somehow photoshopped, I don't know. But as a video idea, I think it's really cool.
Okay.
Whatever. Yeah, I'm an REM completist. I don't care what anyone says. Fuck all of you. I love me REM, so just
well,
go to hell.
Well, REM and John Denver. Those are the ones you want.
I'm so glad I did not get a 25-sheet John Denver saying piece of shit.
There you go. See, it just salves the wound a little bit. And that concludes Jazz Bastard Podcast 156 and our 6 year of podcasting. Thanks for tuning in. We're looking forward to another great year, and it's going to start in 2019. If you'd like to contact us, you can reach Mike at mike@jazzbastard.com or me at pat@jazzbastard.com. You can drop us a line on Facebook, or if you like, look me up on All About Jazz. The podcast can be downloaded from www.jazzbastard.com, from Stitcher, from Apple Podcasts, from Mixcloud, or you can stream it at All About Jazz. Tune in next time as we look at some 2018 releases we didn't have time to get to, and my guess is we'll be going through a stack of those in the next few months. We're going to discuss work by Jordan Pate, Gabriel Zucker, Jason Stein, and a quintet of avant-garde musicians who released an album called Telepatia Liquida. Until next time, enjoy your new year, and take care.